The second lesson he was learning was that if the first ball does not kill, then it seems to numb and anaesthetize heavy game to further punishment. Kill cleanly, or the subsequent shots into heart and lungs seem to be without effect. It was not only anger and provocation which made a wounded animal so dangerous, it was also this shock-induced immortality. After standing down half a dozen mock charges, Zuger abandoned caution and patience, and he ran forward shouting to meet the next charge.
"Whoa there!" he called. "Come on then, old fellow!"
This time he got in close and crashed another ball through the bull's ribcage as he turned away. He had controlled his first wild excitement, and the ball struck precisely at the point of aim. He knew it was a hard shot, but the bull came again, squealing, and Zuger fired a last time before the angry trumpeting and shrilling turned to a long, sad bellow that echoed off the peaks and rang out into the blue void of sky beyond the cliffs. They heard him go down. The impact of the heavy body against the earth made it shiver under their feet. Cautiously, the little group of hunters went forward through the forest, and they found him kneeling, his forelegs folded neatly under his chest, his long yellow ivories propping up the dusty, wrinkled old head, still facing down the slope as though defiant even in death.
"Leave him!" shouted Jan Sharut. "Follow the others!" And they ran on past him.
Night caught them before they reached the crest of the slope, the sudden, impenetrable black night of Central Africa. So they lost the spoor and missed the pass.
"We'll have to let them go,"
Jan Sharut lamented in the darkness, his yellow face a pale blob at Zuger's shoulder.
"Yes," Zuger agreed.
"This time we must let them go." But somehow he knew there would be another time. The feeling that the old bull was part of his destiny was still strongly with Zuger. Yes, there would be another time. Of that he was certain. That night, for the first time, Zuger ate the hunter's greatest delicacy. Slices of elephant heart, threaded onto a green stick with cubes of white fat cut out from the chest cavity, salted and peppered, and roasted over the slow coals of the campfire, eaten with cold cakes of stone-ground corn and washed down with a mug of tea, steaming hot, bitter, strong, and unsweetened. He could not remember a finer meal, and afterwards Zuger lay down on the hard earth, covered by a single blanket, and protected from the chill of the wind by the huge carcass of the old bull, and slept as though he also had been struck down, without dreams, without rolling over even once in his sleep. In the morning, by the time they had chopped out one of the tusks and laid it under the masasa trees, they could already hear the singing of the porters as the main body of the caravan filed along the narrow ledge, rounding the shoulder of the mountain, and then came up to the slope. Robin was 100 paces ahead of the standard-bearer, and when she reached the carcass of the bull, she stopped. "We heard the gunfire last evening," she said. "He's a fine old bull," Zuger told her, indicating the freshly chopped tusk. It was the unbroken right-hand ivory, taller than Zuger, but a third of its length had been buried in the skull. This portion was smooth, unblemished white, whereas the rest of it was stained by vegetable juices. "It will weigh almost 100 pounds, he went on, touching the tusks with the toe of his boot. "Yes, he's a fine old bull." "Not any more, he isn't," Robin told him quietly, watching Jan Sharut and the gun-bearers hacking away at the enormous, mutilated head. Little chips of white bone flew in the early sunlight as they whittled away the heavy skull to free the second tusk. Robin watched the butchery for a few seconds, before going on up the slope towards the crest. Zuger was irritated and angry with her, for she had detracted from his own vaulting pleasure in his first elephant hunt. So an hour later, when he heard Robin calling to him from higher up the slope, he ignored her cries. However, she was persistent, as always, and at last, with an exclamation of exasperation, he followed her up through the forest. She came running down to meet him, with the unrestrained, infectious joy of a child shining on her face.
"Oh, Zuger!"
She seized his hand and began to drag him impetuously up the slope. "Come and see! You must come and see!" The old elephant road crossed the saddle, through a deep pass, guarded on each hand by grey buttresses of rough grey rock, and as they took the last few paces over the highest point, a new and beautiful world opened below and ahead of them. Zuga gasped involuntarily, for he had not anticipated anything like this. Low foothills fell away from beneath their feet, regular as the swells of the ocean, covered with stately trees whose trunks were tall and grey as the oaks of Windsor Park. And then beyond the hills, the undulating, lightly forested grasslands, golden as fields of ripe wheat, spread to a tall blue horizon. There were streams of clear water meandering through the glades of pale grass, where herds of wild game drank or lazed upon the banks. There were buffalo everywhere Zuga looked, black bovine shapes standing shoulder to shoulder in dark masses under the umbrella branches of the acacia trees. Closer at hand, a troop of sable antelope, that loveliest of all antelope, jet black, above, with snowy bellies. Their long symmetrical curve of horn extended backwards almost to touch the haunches, followed the herd bull in long file to the water, pausing unafraid to stare curiously at the interlopers, forming a frieze of stately, almost Grecian design. The endless stretch of land was dotted with hills like ruined natural castles of stone, seeming to have been built in past eons by giants and ogres from mammoth blocks of stone, and tumbled now in fantastic shapes, some with fairy turrets and spires, others again flat-topped, geometrically laid out as though by a meticulous architect with plumb-line and theodolite. This lovely scene was lit by a peculiar pearly luminosity of the morning light, so that even the furthest hills, probably more than 100 miles distant, were sharply silhouetted through the sweet, clear air. "It's beautiful," Robin murmured, still holding Zuga's hand. "The kingdom of Monomotapa," Zuga answered her, his own voice husky with emotion. "No," Robin answered softly, "there is no sign of man here. This is the new Eden." Zuga was silent, letting his eyes rove across the scene, searching for, but not finding, any evidence of man. It was a land untouched, unspoiled. "A new land, there for the taking," he said, still holding Robin's hand. They were as close in that moment as they had ever been or would ever be again, and the land awaited them, wide, limitless, empty, and beautiful. At last, reluctantly, he left Robin at the head of the pass and went back through the grey rock portals to bring on the caravan. He found the second tusk removed, and both of them bound up with bark rope onto the carrying poles of newly cut masasa wood. But the porters had laid aside their packs and were indulging in an orgy of fresh meat, and that most sought after of African spoils, thick white globs of elephant fat. They had cut a trapdoor into the belly of the elephant carcass and pulled out the entrails, and these glistened in the early sunlight, huge rubbery tubes of purple and yellow guts, already swelling and ballooning with the trapped gases they contained. Half a dozen porters, stripped mother naked, had crawled into the interior of the elephant's carcass, disappearing completely from view and wading almost waist-deep in the clotting, congealing bath of trapped blood. They crawled out, painted with it from head to foot, eyes and grinning teeth startlingly white in the grisly, shining, wet red visages, their arms filled with titbits of liver and fat and spleen. These delicacies were hacked into pieces with the blade of an assegai and thrown onto the glowing coals of one of a half dozen fires, then snatched up again, black on the outside and more than half raw within, to be wolfed down with every appearance of ecstatic pleasure. There would be no moving them until they were satiated, Zuga realized. So he left instructions to Yanshurut, himself already pot-bellied with the meat he had gorged, to follow as soon as the carcass had been either eaten or packed up for carrying, and taking the sharp's rifle, returned back up the slope to where he had left Robin. He called for her fruitlessly for almost half an hour, and was really becoming concerned for her safety, when her reply echoed off the cliffs, and looking upwards, he saw her standing on a ledge 100 feet above him, waving him to come up to her. Zuga climbed up swiftly to where she stood on the ledge, and checked the rebuke that he had ready for her when he saw her expression. She was pale, a sickly greyish colour, under the gilding of the sun, and her eyes were reddened and still swimming with tears. "What is it, Sissy?" he asked with quick concern. But she seemed unable to reply, the words choking in her throat, so she had to swallow thickly and motion him to follow her. The ledge on which they stood was narrow but level, and was cut back under the cliff, forming a long, low cavern. The cavern had been used before by other men, for the rocky roof was blackened with the sooty smoke of countless cooking fires, and the back wall was decorated with the lyrically childlike paintings of the little yellow bushmen who, over the centuries, must have used this as a regular camp during their endless wanderings. The paintings lacked both perspective and accurate form, but they captured the essential nature of all they recorded, from the graceful sweep of the giraffe's neck to the bulky shoulders of the Cape buffalo, with the mournful drooping horns framing the lifted nose. The bushman artist saw himself and his tribe as frail, stick-like figures, with drawn bows, dancing and prancing about the quarry. And again, out of all proportion to the rest of the painting, each little man sported a massively erect penis. Even in the heat of the chase, such was the universal conceit of all male kind, Zuga thought. Zuga was enchanted by the frozen cavalcade of man and beast, which covered the walls of the cave, and he had already determined to camp here so that he could have more time to study and record this treasure house of primitive art, when Robin was calling him again. He followed her along the ledge, until they reached the point where it ended abruptly, forming a balcony over the dreaming land ahead of them. Zuga's attention was torn between this fresh vista of forest and glade, and the cave art at his shoulder. But Robin summoned him again impatiently. There were strata of multicoloured rock running horizontally through the rock face of the cliff. The different layers of rock varied in hardness, and the erosion of a softer layer had formed the long, low cavern beyond the ledge. This layer of rock was a soapy green colour, where it had not been painted over by the bushman artists or discoloured by the smoke of their fires. And here, at the point overlooking the empire of Monomotapa, someone had used a metal tool to scrape a smooth, square plaque into the green soapstone. The freshly cut surface stood out rawly, as though it had been done that very day, but the words gave the lie to that impression. There was a simple Christian cross chiseled deeply into the stone, and below it the name and the date, the lettering very carefully cut and designed by an expert penman. It read, "Fuller Morris Ballantyne." Zuga exclaimed aloud at seeing his father's name, so clearly rendered by his father's own hand. Despite the apparent freshness of the cut, the date was 7 years previously, the 20th of July, 1853. After that single exclamation, they were both speechless, staring at the inscription, each of them gripped by differing emotions. Robin by a resurgence of filial love and duty, by a crushing desire to be with her father again after so many years, the vast empty place in her life aching more excruciatingly at the prospect of being soon filled. Her eyes refilled with tears, and they broke from her eyelids and ran down her cheeks. "Please, God," she prayed silently, "lead me to my father. Dear God, grant me that I am not too late." Zuga's emotions were as strong, but different. He felt a corroding resentment that any other man, father or not, should have preceded him through these rocky gates into the kingdom of Monomotapa.